Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today, one of the most exciting breakthroughs we've been able to bring you on this show, our special guest, Dr. Carmen Bolter, well known for her fascinating five-part Netflix documentary, The Pyramid Code, which gave a new view on ancient Egypt, joins us today to share fascinating findings that will change forever the accepted version of ancient history. Now, Carmen is no stranger to controversy and groundbreaking facts. Her upcoming documentary series, The New Atlantis, will present evidence that an advanced, forgotten culture was the forerunner for civilization everywhere. Today's revelations about the pharaoh Akhenaten may reveal the crucial ties, finally, to ancient Atlantis. Here we go. Dr. Carmen Bolter. Akhenaten discovery changes history forever.
There's some fancy talk and all that, and there's stories that have been tried to be told to distract us. But one of the things that Nefertiti, Akhenaten, and Tut all had in common was a distended skull. Funny-shaped hat covers funny-shaped head, which, you know, may mean that they, you know, that they were legendary from another time. They were representing something that was far, far older, and they were highly developed, and that's why that was what would be reflected in the distended skull, which would have more room for an enlarged pineal gland that would have made them truly spiritual and connected.
You know, we've seen discoveries that change our perspective of what really took place in our ancient past come to be accepted and even embraced over time by standard archaeology, depending on the kind of political and academic atmosphere that's taking place. Discoveries like the Rosetta Stone, celebrated now but scorned in its time, or the geological redating of the Sphinx, which is still not accepted by Egyptology, completely reshape our understanding of who we are. This two-part special report will certainly collapse one version of history. And we may have to sift through that rubble to discover what it means to our civilization now. Will the radical redating of our history and its accompanying paradigm shift be accepted by the world at large? Let's go ask Dr. Carmen Bolter.
Dark Journalist. Go for truth in 2017. The deepest questions. The biggest secrets. The darkest mysteries. Dark Journalist. Go for truth. With top guests like Graham Hancock.
Graham, how do we as a society escape the grip of the deep state in the 21st century?
Rather than spending trillions of dollars every year on building up our armies and our weapons of mass destruction and creating a climate of hatred and fear and suspicion, we should be uniting as a human race.
Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, what is the issue that's holding us back and destroying prosperity?
We have a system which has got a negative return on investment. It's killing human productivity, and where it's going is inhuman.
Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, you've been fighting against secrecy your whole life. How are we doing in this battle?
There is a kind of energy and synergy that you and I have because we are both trying so hard in so many facets to get to the bottom of what is the truth.
Dark Journalist. Go for truth. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll receive exclusive member benefits, including access to the complete high-quality audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, and subscriber-only content, including bonus show material. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, this is the year. Now is the time.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Join us now and go for truth.
Well, hello everyone. 2017 is full of surprises so far, and this special episode is no exception. I'm pleased to report that today marks a very special day for the world of true history. We have Dr. Carmen Bolter here in part one. We're going to show you some photographic evidence that will rock the entire dating structure of ancient Egypt to pieces. It's the real deal, and the information is coming out slowly with a lot of impact. A very special Dark Journalist episode for you today with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Now, a quick reminder to sign up for our newsletter at darkjournalist.com so you don't miss any of the exciting revelations that we have coming up for you. Carmen, it's great to welcome you back to the show, and I really appreciate you coming on knowing what a radically busy schedule that you have right now.
I've been refusing all these interviews. My God, I've got so many interviews, and I'm like, no, I can't do anymore. But I thought, no, this is different.
That's awesome.
So thanks for being you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm very excited to have you here and that you chose to reveal what I think are earth-shattering revelations that will change history right here on this show. So before we get into that, now everyone is waiting in suspense for your new documentary series, a 5-part series called The New Atlantis. Before we get into everything, can you give us a quick update on that?
I've got footage from 14 countries, aerial footage, underwater footage, interviews with, 16 different people.
Now shooting is complete. You're actually in post-production now, right?
Oh, yeah. I've been in post-production for a while. I've been working on the animations for 8 or 9 months.
That sounds terrific.
So there's stuff there for sure.
Now, without giving the entire series away, can you share with us now just some of the high points that you'll be bringing forward in these 5 episodes?
Well, there's footage inside the tunnel system of the Bosnian pyramids and outside, and interviews with Dr. Sam in the field, and then Dr. Sam at the Global Pyramid Conference talking about the 80,000 pyramids in the world and where they are. And then I've got Gunung Padang, which is a 29,000-year-old pyramid in Java.
Wow.
And then the experts in the field. And I spoke at a conference there with other people who are looking at where Atlantis almost certainly could have been, which all 33 points that Plato talks about are included there. So that's developed. There's all the stuff about the electric ancient Egyptians and the material that James Ernest Brown is bringing in, including his Arcs and Sparks lab and extensive interviews with him. I've got footage of the Bimini Road with dolphins swimming underwater footage. I've got, aerial footage from lots of different places, Teotihuacan, lots of places. I got footage from Bolivia, the storyline of Tomsk, Russia in Siberia, where they're building pyramids now. So a series of 33 pyramids, and there's 12 different domains that they're doing paradigm shifts in. So that's what I'm calling new futures. So it's almost like the pyramid code's in the middle, and this goes behind to the distant past and then into now. How is this useful? So paradigm shifts in communication, transportation, education, health, all 12 different domains where they're revising in Russia how we can make things work better for people. And so that's all in there. And yeah, lots of interviews in the field.
Now, one thing that we've discussed that will play right into these big revelations that we're going to lay out here today has to do with this major discovery that's in the documentary and maybe a crucial bellwether for this idea of one central advanced civilization forgotten in ancient times that spread across the globe, influencing many other cultures. Now, can you tell us about it?
There's a temple called Penataran in Java, where different groupings are shown from around the world. So Mayan, Vedic Indian, Chinese, Egyptian, Sumerian, Greek. I got them all in one temple.
Huh.
So I'm subscribing to the idea of a third party hypothesis. And so each of these groups have astronomy, pyramid building, commerce, sacred geometry, right? Mm-hmm. And, vast knowledge of science, but they each have their own style and they don't look like they're related, and it doesn't look like they were ever speaking to one another. But it could well be that they were already distinct cultural groups in Atlantis, and when there was a catastrophe, they were sent in their own groupings to Mexico, to China, right? And so I've likened that to, the hip-hop kids who have their own music and their own way of dressing, ballerinas, firemen. They all existed as cultural groups already in Atlantis and went with their own to colonize. Something like that. I'm also looking through the ancient texts and correlating it with astrophysics and that sort of thing. And from what I'm seeing, there were 4 distinct disasters. So 11,600 years ago, 17,500 58,000 years ago, and 85,000 years ago. And so the place where Atlantis almost certainly was is where 3 tectonic plates meet, and there's 3 volcanoes. And so the stress and strain on the Ring of Fire was what had it break apart more than once. And so this means that that's several precessional cycles, which means it could have been in a golden age and then in an iron age and back up to a golden age, and with different things going on in between. And so we need to change our way of thinking. So in the same way that the Pyramid Code made timelines that allowed people to start thinking further behind, because you have to learn almost how to think that way, because school and religion has insisted that we're 6,000 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we learn to open our consciousness to think about, you know, how life could be different, you know, without government controls and focus on money and that sort of thing. And so it's weaving together lifestyle and possible locations of where, you know, Atlantis could have been, and weaving a lot of very, very ancient stories.
Wow, that's really amazing and loaded with implications. And what's really fascinating for me is that you're placing this root culture right there in the Ring of Fire.
Sundaland.
Right.
Sundaland. North of Java, the Sunda Strait. And there's, and speaking at a conference last year, everyone was presenting on the physical, hardcore evidence of Atlantis being in Java.
Amazing.
And it's real. It's there. Mauricio Santos and now his son, Antonio, have done a lot of work on how that's so. Danny Hillman, another Danny or Watto, they've done a lot of work on showing that it likely was in the Pacific. And I've done some work on the hill tribes all the way through. If you think of Japan, and the bottom of Japan is the top of Philippines, the bottom of the Philippines is the top of Indonesia, all those places, then you go all the way down to New Zealand and Easter Island. And their hill tribes all have the same red, white, and black, same kind of patterns. They build their ships the same way. You know, they wear feathers. And they have a similar tradition. And so all of that land could have been, you know, filled in and not scattered islands. But every time there was an earth disaster, the water levels went up and made it more into scattered islands.
Interesting.
But I think that that land mass would have, you know, been bigger, and that parts of it just cracked off and sank.
Fascinating. Now, do you think, and certainly there's some evidence for this, but do you think that there was a large landmass in the Atlantic Ocean that was submerged where this root culture was dominant? And that might be the reason why we have so many legends that connect this ocean with the Atlantean culture.
Well, they say Santorini was a good candidate, but it's still there.
Yeah.
Right. So if it's gone, it's got to be gone. So I think that, as I mentioned before, that there are reasons why that we want to think of it in the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't really strong colonies in Crete, in around Gibraltar in Spain, Troy, you know, various places, even Mycenae, where they were doing various in Egypt and all of that. So there were colonies all around, but I don't think that that was grand central, what Plato was talking about. Now, we build our cities all the same on rivers with skyscrapers, and mostly you look at, you know, Singapore, London, New York, and it's the way we build cities.
Right.
And I think the Atlanteans, as a worldwide seafaring culture, built their cities in a way that there was an entrance, and then it would go around, and the ships would drop their cargo and then keep going around, and they'd pick up more cargo, and then they'd go out the other way, and that the city states were, you know, in the middle, and then the population lived around it. So I think that there are several places where they found something that looks round and evidence off the coast of Spain in various places, but I don't think that's where the whole thing was. So during right around before the whole thing went down at 11,600 some years ago, the rest of the world was in an ice age, and Atlantis was on the equator, and I think it truly was paradise.
Okay, it makes sense. It would really, you know, especially being in an ice age, knowing about this culture where everything was, you know, in the hot zone there, it would invite those legends of paradise.
Well, sure. And the other thing is that, you know, all these incredible hardwoods and aromatherapy and jewels and different kinds of metals and Heraklion and all this stuff was there. And so what we see, if you go looking for documentaries on Atlantis, you'll have people say, well, you know, Plato was traumatized because Socrates was put to death, and so he made up a story to make himself feel better, and the story was Atlantis.
Oh, right.
Right, right. That's a good one. And no, not 9,000 years, 9,000 moons.
Hmm.
You know, and these people are just, you know, talking in definitives as though that they know.
Right.
And so they build up, you know, the submersibles off the coast of Cuba, and, you know, and they found crystals and this and that. Yeah, but there's no elephants. So it's got to be a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so where do you have, you know, three seasons and the size of that altiplano and the wrapping around of mountains and, you know, the river system and all these different possibilities? Well, it does exist somewhere. It did exist. But we don't want to think of it as Asian. We want to think of it as Western.
I see. So
there's been all this concerted effort to confuse us. And then this whole oppositional thing where look over here, no, look over here. And so, you know, we've lost our way. And it's really frustrating for me to watch things, documentaries on Atlantis, because they're basically trying to negate it. So they build it up and talk to people and go, no, that never happened. But there isn't very much that's building toward it did happen. And everything Plato said was true.
Mm-hmm. You know, we do have, it's amazing, there were so many teachings that came out in the 19th century around theosophy and anthroposophy. A lot of esoteric traditions suddenly brought Atlantis to the surface in a lot of ways, which I think is a very interesting wave if you study it. There was a kind of a big wave of interest in Atlantis, Ignatius Donnelly in the Antediluvian, that's a great book, and there is this kind of feeling that people were rediscovering, reawakening their minds about it. And then, you know, we had things popping up like the mound builders. We started to understand with all these mound builders around America. Do you think that the mound builders are a piece of this Atlantis story?
I do, and it's making me think about the 75% of the stone circles in the world are in Ireland. And they all seem to be pointing to astronomical configurations. And it's almost as though people who survived, and there would have been survivors of each of these catastrophes and relocation, were trying to take that ancient knowledge and ground it and put it into something that would remain. And it's almost like there's a real sense of urgency. And James Swagger is someone who's, you know, been on top of all of that. And the mounds are the same as that. Now, a lot of these stone circles are also passage graves, they call them, which is similar to the mounds. And through geoscans, I've got the images around Stonehenge and around Glastonbury, where 10 miles across, there are these passage graves that go all the way around in concentric circles that are absolutely enormous and very deep. See, this is what we're able to look at now with geoscans,
Right?
Because it goes 6 kilometers deep.
Right. So can you give us just some idea here of what was found? Because I know now we're getting into some deep territory here.
And this is as way out as we can go.
Right. Yeah.
So you think we've got mind-blowing things. This is even more mind-blowing. Because it seems that the high-level initiates were able to will themselves when it was time to drop this earthly body.
Whoa.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And so they consciously would die, pass, and have a full understanding of what it was like to be on the other side, because they would do out-of-body experiences, which is part of what my research is doing, and that's also part of the New Atlantis in the Great Pyramid and the sarcophagus and what it meant to experience those things, practice leaving the body and coming back.
That really is fascinating.
So each of these places is equidistant, and there's actually a map, an anti-gravity design that one of the developers of geoscans was working at a university coming up with this anti-gravity solution, if you will. And he was fired, and he had to sign a gag order for 20 years, which lifted. So it's 1996 to 2016. So once he was able to talk, he started to contact me and show me this stuff. So under Glastonbury is Passage Graves in the pattern of his anti-gravity with a Knights Templar cross passageways underneath where Glastonbury would have been beside Avalon, right? So if these are really passage graves, what does that mean? And what are they finding inside these graves? Not bone. Not clothes, not pottery, not grave goods. Crystal. As though their bodies were turning into a crystalline matrix. And they'd go in there to pass consciously and they turn to crystal. Like, what? And the mounds are part of that.
That is seriously intriguing. And since we mentioned initiates and esoteric themes, as we're leading up here to the big reveal of these artifacts that were discovered, I want to take a moment briefly and reflect on Edgar Cayce's readings on Atlantis. One of the fascinating passages talks about a Tuatha stone, this incredible yet also very dangerous firestone crystal that the Atlanteans used to power their advanced airships and supply energy to their civilization. What is it about crystal that seems to hold the link, not only to ancient and advanced modern technology, but also for communication with higher realms, for example? As these initiates willing themselves into crystal suggests, there's a major spiritual aspect here. So what properties exist in crystal to make it so unique?
Excellent question. Well, crystals are essential in terms of pyramid building. I bet you didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
Okay, so quartz has a double helix in its makeup. And when that is under pressure, it emits energy. And so if you look at how they were building the pyramids, the new pyramids in Russia, they've got 14-foot tall crystals from Brazil. And then they're making geopolymer blocks that actually are built around. So when it looks like dead space in a pyramid that isn't part of where the chambers are, that's full of quartz under pressure. And that's the essence of pyramid power.
Fascinating.
Which is also part of the New Atlantis.
That's great. I'm glad you included that in there. There is something that's come up in research circles about the reason why the builders of the Great Pyramid at Giza used granite. And there's been the suggestion that granite is a kind of transmitter. Now, in your mind, is there a reason they chose granite?
It's got quartz in it.
Huh.
Granite has crystal in it.
That is connecting some dots.
Yeah, yeah. That's part of the composition. If you look at polished granite countertops, it's reflective.
Okay.
Because it's crystal.
Right, exactly. We're back to crystal again. So the picture is really starting to form here. And I really want to say, aside from all of your great travels and excavations and your extraordinary academic background, University of Calgary, all of your high-end research credentials and affiliations, but you do something very special. You integrate and rely upon your psychic intuitive sense to guide your research. Now, for me, that makes your work very different, totally different than anyone in the field, in my opinion. It's exceptional. Now, when you're integrating your intuitive side into your research, what is it that takes place there? What is the process like? And, you know, is it like you get hunches, impulses? What are the things that happen?
I'm liking these questions.
Oh, good.
Okay. In terms, I taught quantitative research methods to PhD and master's students at the University of Calgary. And you start with a research question, right? Is there a relationship between this and that? And what I've come to see with my own work is that the research question can come from a past life memory, from something psychic, right?
Yeah.
But then you do the work of developing a hypothesis, a directional hypothesis, of collecting data, and seeing if the data supports the hypothesis or doesn't. But of all the research studies I've done in that pure sense, I've been wrong every time, because I was looking at things in too shallow a way. Like, my best guess starting out collecting data and doing the research was naive. And that the data, what happens when you look at the data is you have to explain what you found. And either it supports the hypothesis or it doesn't. But in the explanation, you also have to do a literature review of he said, she said, what everybody said about it, right? To position what you're doing, and to also make it replicatable, so that if you lay out your research in the proper way, then somebody else can come along and do exactly what you did, and they have the information about what you did, and they can do it again. Mm-hmm. And chances are they'll have similar findings. But my point is that a past life recall, a dream, something psychic can be the fundamental of the question. It's not the answer. It's not the research, but you can start anywhere. And that's what I've been doing, is chasing around my past life memories. So by the time I was 30, I had evidence of 85 of my own past lives, and then I stopped counting.
Wow.
So I know stuff, but a lot of times I don't know why I know it for a long time. But then it comes together, and it's triangulated, and it's not just in a text. It's also astrophysics or something, and the verification comes. And so what we're looking for is validity and reliability in research. Validity is, are you measuring what you think you're measuring? Now, when you get A, B, C, D, one, you know, somewhat like, don't like, you know, not likely at all, those are called like. And people don't even know what you're asking, so they pick three. They pick the middle one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you're not measuring what you think you're measuring with those. It's just too vague. People don't know what you're asking.
Yes.
Right? So that's not a valid test. So what makes a test valid? And then reliability is what I just said about being able to do it again. But as I've been mentioning with geoscans, the more they go and do a test and or do a scan and then dig and find that things are at the same depth in the location that they thought, that's increasing the validity and the reliability of the test.
Hmm.
Right? Because they're coming up, you know, 100%, 99% of what they think they're looking for, they find it. So we've got a pretty good test there. So, yeah, so I think that past life recall is the key to the question, not the key to the answer.
Fascinating. Well, considering what we're about to lay out publicly in reference to the Pharaoh Akhenaten and these discoveries, bringing together that intuitive sense in your research, can you give me an idea of what you intuitively feel the Amarna period was all about? Of course, the way it's portrayed by standard archaeology is nowhere near the whole story. We can certainly say there was a kind of political, spiritual earthquake that was happening in a number of ways. Akhenaten introducing the Aten god symbol, Nefertiti by his side, moving the capital of Egypt, throwing out the corrupt priesthood. What do you sense was happening there during all this?
Well, Egypt was deteriorating. And the Amun priesthood was taking half of everybody's crop for the temple. And so that's kind of like, we pay 50% of what we earn now, give it to the government. And so, you know, they were trying to sell spirituality in some way. And it wasn't really spiritual. So you needed, you know, the temple and the priests to, and it was disempowering to people. So I think Akhenaten and Nefertiti went, you know what? We're not doing this with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they moved to a new place and they started Amarna. And it was absolutely like paradise. So it was the flattening of the hierarchies. So everybody had the opportunity for creativity. And it flourished in terms of art, peace, and everything, but people's well-being. And it was probably, if you look at society, it was the last time there was peace on the planet.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it's just been warring and stuff. And the Amun priesthood wanted the power back because they wanted, and Amun means darkness. So they wanted the power back. And so they plotted to overtake them. But during the Amarna period, it was percolating back from a time of true spirituality, and I'm going to go as far as to say Atlantean energy.
Right.
And the 18th dynasty was when that was, and the great-great-great-grandmother of Akhenaten would have been Hatshepsut. So they tumbled through, and it was the same family pattern. And then it ended with Akhenaten, and, well, then it went to Tut, and then it went to Smenkhare, and then it went to Horemheb, who was the army general. And then it ended, and Horemheb's friend was Ramses I, and then it went to the 19th dynasty. So basically the whole thing came crashing down to a horrible ending. And they basically flattened it, and they took a bunch of stuff from Amarna. And, you know, once they realized that Tut was of the Aten, and he was trained to be Amun and Aten,
yeah, right,
the light, and to know how to make up that he was of the Amun, and then somebody figured it out and killed him. And then they just, you know, there was this, I think that room, that the King Tut's tomb was for a stash of mummies because it's exceedingly small.
Mm-hmm.
And they just took a bunch of stuff from Amarna and threw it in there.
Unbelievable.
Unceremoniously. It's one of the smallest tombs around. And then they had that whole thing that there was a secret passage and Nefertiti was in there.
Yes.
I think we talked about that before.
Well, what's interesting about that is it came up around the time you were getting these strange revelations for the Turkish find. So I found it's a weird timing.
Well, and the thing is, I don't know if you saw those images, but I did a superimposition of the artist rendition of King Tut's tomb, and then the stuff when it was full. And the door that went to where the stuff is the door that they say is secret and Nefertiti was in there. Well, first of all, these tombs are hermetically sealed, right? So you don't open it up and throw somebody else in there, mm-hmm. which means Nefertiti would have had to die the same day.
Yeah, that's hard.
But the thing is, that's where the stuff was. It's not a secret door. It's the door. It's the door where the stuff was.
All right.
Right? And so, and not only that, in 2009, Joanne, I forget her last name, but she was doing work with hair and wigs. And she found three royal mummies of women and suggested that one of them was Nefertiti. Joanne Fletcher.
Oh, yes.
And so it was like, we found her. Well, if you found her, then what do you have to find her again for?
Exactly.
And so we're just, you know, they just shovel all these stories, you know, and make stuff up and people, oh, okay.
Absurd,
oh, oh.
Yeah.
But there's no logic to it. To me, it's not logical at all. Anyway, it's like I'm very opinionated.
No, I can appreciate it.
Yeah. And so, but even what we're talking about now, like, and the last line in the Pyramid Code, how would our society change if consciousness was the highest value instead of profit? So, you know, building on consciousness, building on creativity, constructivism, you know, meaning-centered learning is unpopular because it's stick 'em up. We want your money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
It's like 212 ways of taxing us and having people go around in circles making money to give to the system. You know, and so everybody accepts that. I don't accept that.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. A couple of things from what you just said. That quick succession of pharaohs there running through Akhenaten. And I think even A, right, the prince, the priest A, is that his name? He took power at a certain point. That's what it is. So you have Akhenaten, Smenkhare, I, Tut, Horemheb. I mean, do you ever see a succession like that so fast in Egyptian history? It seems very unusual, like huge upheaval.
No, because the thing was broken.
Right.
Tut came right after Akhenaten. And he was only 8 when he ascended to the throne, 8 or 9, and was there for 10 years. But most assuredly would have had a co-regent or somebody, you know, helping him.
Mm-hmm.
There was a shortage of boy babies.
Right.
Nefertiti had 6 daughters, no sons. Something to do with solar flares and infertility. And I think we're coming up against something like that, too, that there's less and less fertility, right? In our days when we were growing up, that wasn't the case. And so that's part of the problem. And now with Hatshepsut too. I mean, she was a female pharaoh.
Yes.
Right? And so, yeah, it was patriarchal Egypt with spirituality percolating up and the patriarchal forces wanting the power. Disempowered people, give us your money, give us your grain, give us your crop. And they were fighting against that.
They're remarkable people, and they stand out dramatically in history. We seem to have rediscovered them in a big way in the last century. King Tut's tomb, of course, the legendary bust of Nefertiti, Akhenaten. My goodness, they seem to be the living embodiment of ancient Egypt in so many ways. And we've seen a concerted effort in modern Egyptology to portray them almost as oddball, grotesque, or diseased in some way, running around saying Akhenaten had some bizarre condition. But it seems in the collective unconscious, we really understand there was something very special about them. And I think you alluded to that fact when you tracked your own past lives there at Amarna. Being around during that period was such a unique experience, almost like being there for Camelot or something. Now, one of the things you touched on briefly was this succession of passing things down, not only ideas, but actual people. So, for example, the find we're going to look at shortly is perhaps 8,000 years older than Tut's tomb, and yet it resembles the royal design almost perfectly. And you mentioned there hand-me-downs from this older culture, let's call it Atlantis here. But not only these holy possessions were handed down, but also names. And the names may represent a tradition of an individual being repeated again and again. So, you know, in Persia, for example, they had Zoroaster in 500 BC, but there's a Zoroaster in 3000 BC. That's 2,500 years difference. So what kind of succession is this? You know, they're transferring these people, Akhenaten and Nefertiti, down the consciousness through the ages, through centuries, representing this initial special personage.
You're a delight.
Thank you.
Because you're thinking on your feet and you're getting it. So there's some fancy talk in all that. And there's stories that have been tried to be told to distract us. But one of the things that Nefertiti, Akhenaten, and Tut all had in common was a distended skull.
Right.
Funny-shaped hat covers funny-shaped head. And which, you know, may mean that they, you know, yeah, that they were legendary from another time. But they were representing something that was far, far older. And it started, you can even see Amenhotep II in his temple in Kalabsha, what's called Kalabsha. But you know, when they made the Aswan Dam, 18 temples were drowned.
Oh.
And they knew that Abu Simbel was going to drown. And whoops, the Temple of Isis. So, you know, part of the year it was three quarters drowned. And then they built another dam to get it out and cut it into pieces and put it on the island of Philae. But 16 other temples ended up underwater, and Kalabsha is one of them. And so they've got them all out now. But it took UNESCO, like, many, many, many years to do it. And so Kalabsha has got, you know, wall to wall, ceiling to floor frescoes that are basically describing so how Amenhotep III was the son, who was Akhenaten's father, right? Because he was Amenhotep IV until he changed it to Akhenaten instead of Amen, right? Because that was the whole thing.
Okay.
But it didn't just happen like that. It was three generations, which also was coming back to Hatshepsut before that, right? And so they were slowly schooled in a way, and you can see this progression of how they were working with energy and the gods and goddesses and the way, like, you see a child has got a tuft of hair, and sometimes they have a finger pointing toward their face. And so it was this whole progression of how Amenhotep II grew up, and Amenhotep III was the one that seemed to be such a prolific builder, and that aquiline face that then Chris Dunn is talking about that as Ramses. But as I mentioned, he's admitted that it actually could have, well, I was going to say it could be Amenhotep III. Well, you know, maybe they were interchanging all these names, and the legend came from farther back, and that they were emulating it. And I think that we just have to, you know, open our psyches to the possibilities of how these stories came down and what it really meant.
Yeah.
But the long and short of it is that they were highly intuitive and they were highly developed. And that's why that's what would be reflected in the distended skull, which would have more room for an enlarged pineal gland that would have made them truly spiritual and connected, not religious.
That is so interesting, and I think at this point we've put enough of a context out there that will help everyone watching make sense of these amazing discoveries that will push the history of Egypt back thousands of years and tie it to this Atlantean culture and raise some serious questions about the origins of this royal family. Explosive revelations coming up here with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, a saucer came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
This two-part special report will certainly collapse one version of history, and we may have to sift through that rubble to discover what it means to our civilization now.
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption, because it is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Now, Carmen is a major authority on ancient Egypt and produced the stunning five-part Pyramid Code documentary on Netflix. She has a completely new documentary series coming up called The New Atlantis. And before we're done today, we're going to show you how to help her complete this heroic project. Carmen, for this special episode, has brought to the show some images that even now as I discuss them, I'm convinced will indeed change our view on ancient history. We'll get right to them right after I ask you, Carmen, about your new tour of Egypt coming up. March 18th, you're leaving. So that's really right around the corner. Anyone can get details on this at pyramidcode.com. And that's correct, isn't it? The info is all available there.
Yeah. So, pyramidcode.com. Well, pyramidcode.com's got the contact, and then my email's posted.
That's great. All the details are there.
But you can just see the program right here. So it's got the day by day and the where we'll stay and the whole thing.
Okay, the whole thing is here.
And the travel details and the ship and all that stuff.
How many times have you led this tour to Egypt?
Well, I've been to Egypt 30 times. I lived there for a couple of years, 2.5 years.
Wow.
So this is the Pyramid Code Live. And even before the Pyramid Code, I was leading these tours to those places, and that's how the Pyramid Code came about, because I was piecing together all these different things. So I've done it. I've led it several times since 1996.
One of the wonderful things in the Pyramid Code is your relationship with the Wisdom Keeper, who was at the pyramids. Yes.
You know, and he passed away. Like, the editors were there, and they were building, you know, the interviews. And, you know, I called it the Bible, where, you know, the sound bites for the interviews and the footage and all that stuff. And Hakim was like the cherry on the icing on the cake, because I had, in my mind, I was finding scientists that would corroborate what he said, because he just knew stuff. But he didn't trace. He didn't feel he needed to do that, to trace how he knew or what. And so I kept saying, like, Is Hakim in yet? Is Hakim in yet? And I go, why do you even care? It's like, well, is he in there? And he said, okay, watch me. I'm dragging the footage into the timeline. Okay, Hakim's in. And I got this kind of, and 15 minutes later, I got an email from his kids that he died 15 minutes before, that he wouldn't leave until he was in it. And he died the second he was in there. And he was bugging me. He's like, I gotta go.
Well, he's truly a powerful presence there. And this is the perfect segue into this astonishing find. Now, the nature of this find is so extraordinary. I see it on the level of Carter finding Tut's tomb in 1922. Set this up for us a little bit. The team that discovered it are Turkish. Tell us how you first met them, got to know them, and we'll go from there.
I was working, doing an internship, leading the, like supervising the internship of a woman whose sister moved to Turkey. She got sick of her life. And she married a Turkish guy. Mm-hmm. And the story there is that his brother, cousin, was walking along when he was 6 years old, and his leg fell in a hole. He was walking across a field. So he pulls his leg out and looks down the hole and sees all this gold. And then a bunch of snakes. So he ran away.
Huh.
And then he spent the rest of his life saying, what was that anyway? So they became a treasure hunter. So his brother and him became treasure hunters, and they actually found this stuff.
Now let's take a look at some of these initial breakthrough images, and we'll explain them as we go, and also talk more about the state of the discovery itself. So what are the first images here? So
there's two pictures. Okay, well, here's one. And it looks like King Tut's sarcophagus. Look at this. And there's...
Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this one from?
And then all these Shapki dolls. Whoops, that happens to be Turkey.
This is earth-shattering. Now, just to tie this all together, we touched on this Turkish team of investigators last spring. They had contacted you, mm-hmm. and from the information they gave you, you deduced that not only was this final proof of an older link from Atlantis to ancient Egypt, but it also suggested the reason Nefertiti disappears from history right after the corrupt priesthood takes Akhenaten down with the military is because she escaped. And in this case, she escaped to Turkey with important heirlooms from Amarna. Is this the discovery that we're looking at here?
It certainly is. And I'm just looking for where the other one is. Because there's all the gods and goddesses. Now, but the point of this is that they scrape away the gold and get some wood to date. And these are dated to 11,500 years ago.
Amazing. First, what are the implications of this dating?
Which means that they would have been like grandma's silver in China being handed down the generations, which means they would be Atlantean before they were Egyptian.
Incredible, undeniable link of the root Atlantean culture, handing down the sarcophagus tradition to ancient Egypt. Just amazing.
And then there's Amenhotep III, and then there's Akhenaten, and then there's all the Sekhmet, Anubis, you know, all of the different gods and goddesses. And everybody's been trying to say that Akhenaten went to one god. No, no, and no.
Right, well, they're certainly taking liberties with the facts there. And one thing we should make clear here, since this find is located in Turkey, is that Nefertiti would have fled with her entourage mm-hmm. and these important pieces. She would have made it to Turkey and hidden these treasures, no doubt with Egypt under siege, the corrupt Amun priesthood seizing power, removing Akhenaten's name from history. They would have pursued her also. So she fled and went into hiding. Can you play out the scenario for us as you see it now?
Okay, imagine that... the Amun priesthood coming to kill Akhenaten. And I say that they killed him, cut him up into 14 pieces and threw him into the river, which is where that whole, whether they were copycatting the Osiris myth or that was part of the distortion and they created the Osiris myth from it. And Nefertiti knew they were coming. This is me reflecting and trying to come up with a scenario about how all this gold stuff would have ended up, or sorry, outside of Egypt in Turkey.
Uh-huh.
But if they said, okay, we've got a couple of carriages here and, you know, take what makes sense that would show the world what we were really about instead of what they're going to end up saying about us. Mm-hmm. And if you look at this sarcophagus, you can see there's no opening. So I'm suggesting this is how they made them. This is very, very reminiscent of Hatshepsut, who was the beginning of the 18th dynasty.
Right.
And then this is Nekhbet, the vulture. And it seems to me that this is almost drawn on, and then they were going to do the inlay later of real jewels. But nothing looks like King Tut's sarcophagus as much as this does.
Right, absolutely. And it's a stunning likeness. I would think that Tut was actually in there. Now, I know you were saying it's not finished, but are we sure that there's no royal mummy in there?
I doubt it, because what I'm trying to say is I think that these things were fashioned first, then cut open, then the insides were created, and then the mummy went in, and that they took this when it was not finished. I think it's unfinished. But it does make a link to Tut. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that if there's a statue of Akhenaten and his father. Now, Chris Dunn talks about Ramses and the even face and, you know,
yes,
how tall. And I sat across from him at a speaker's dinner and I said, do you really think that's Ramses? He goes, no. And I go, well, why do you keep telling everybody it's Ramses when it's Amenhotep III? And he says, well, it's easier that way and people know who Ramses is.
That's a ridiculous reason.
And I'm like, well, you know, like, sorry, but I completely disagree. But the long and short of it is that if Akhenaten and all this stuff that they were doing, the other thing, it's all of this King Tut stuff and Amarna, everything that was in King Tut's tomb is part of this electric ancient Egyptian stuff. Mm-hmm. The Senet game, which is all the cosmology, all that stuff. They could have easily inherited it from Atlantis.
Definitely.
Well, then were Nefertiti and Akhenaten real people? Or, you know, it's almost like the Victorian stuff, you know, like that we end up copying and the ancestors were really somebody else. Like, it raises all these different questions. And I'm pretty sure that a good question's better than a poor answer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, that is fascinating.
Totally. It's totally fascinating. But the other thing is that I had my cameras charging, and they said, wait till Monday, you know, before you buy your ticket. And I was going to go film this stuff because these are just taken with a cell phone. And next thing you know, the Turkish border is going to close. They're kicking all the Americans out. Hmm. And now all the refugees are coming. And this is right on the Silk Road.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And there's 10 rooms that were hewn out of a mountain.
Yeah, and that's as much as we can say about the location, because I know for now there's a strange military complication. But we'll have more on that soon. This is unbelievable stuff.
Unbelievable stuff.
It's funny, you know, and speaking about the military activity near the site, we just did an episode on archaeology wars.
Oh, yeah.
Which focused on objects looted from the Baghdad Museum during the Iraq War. And I have no doubt the political agenda is a major part when you find something like this. You know, strange tensions arise on the surface to drive everyone away from the find and move their forces in so they can get their hands on it. And I'm glad to hear so far it's safe, and I hope it continues to stay that way.
I know.
Now, Carmen, what I'd like you to do is describe and lead us through these ancient treasures. If you can use a pointer and tell us what we're looking at in these deep images.
Okay, so here is Akhenaten. See him right there?
Yes.
This is Amenhotep III. Okay, this whole thing, this so-called mummification bed, is the whole thing about the electric ancient Egyptians. So you've got Ptah and Isis, right? Mm-hmm. And Nefertum and Thoth, right? And they're all there. So this is the edge of the sarcophagus from the other picture.
Oh, okay, yes.
This is just turning to the left.
Uh-huh.
And it's just all thrown in there.
Remarkable.
And then this is part of that Senmet game.
Unbelievable.
Right, where the puzzle pieces are in there. It is unbelievable. It's gold.
Incredible.
See, here's a crocodile, and that was part of what they worked with.
What I think is so fascinating is what you just said, really. It looks like it was thrown in there, as if Nefertiti was saying, I'm on the run.
Exactly.
I have to hide these precious items and ditch all of this stuff, bury it, and save it as best I can.
Exactly. Okay. I just about had a heart attack when I saw them. But look at this. Look at the jewels on that thing.
It's exquisite.
Oh, yeah. Okay, here. This one. This is 8,000 diamonds of different colors. Yeah?
Fantastic.
So, and this is the kind of thing that you would see outside.
Okay.
Right? And so pointing to various things, right, to try to find the places. And then look at this, Sumerian cylinder seals.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and here's another one of those. X marks the spot. But there were some coins. And here's another one of that falcon. So you see how this is not Egyptian.
Yeah.
Right? With the big, I mean, I'm guessing it's more like Persian. But it's like, you know, stick them up, give us your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All this goddess-centered stuff. You know, and then the next guy comes along, stick them up, give us your stuff.
Oh, it's mind-bending.
Right, this is how the pictures came to me.
Now, the people doing this excavating in Turkey, are they on the run?
On the run.
Actually, it's all well, right. It's all right. I understand their plans are sensitive right now, so we'll leave that question. We have many more images to look at, including the burial mummy of an Atlantean princess wearing a very interesting crown. These are powerful images that throw out all the traditional assumptions, and you're not going to see this on National Geographic, I'm afraid. It's too hot to handle, folks. We're going to go into part two and show you some more of these stunning images and the Atlantean ties to all of it with a more detailed look at the excavation. Dark Journalist subscribers will get this episode in their inbox next week. Now is the time to subscribe at darkjournalist.com. Carmen, you're in the midst of a GoFundMe campaign to finish the New Atlantis documentary series as we speak, so I'll put the details up. Can you tell us, in your own words, what the New Atlantis is all about?
The New Atlantis, I think, is our hope for a model for an empowered humanity. And we've lost our way. And if there's any clues that we can find from a completely sane time, when it was paradise, with riches enough for everyone, and health, if we can replicate that in any way, psychologically, mentally, spiritually, I think that that's the hope for our future.
There's no question. You've made such headway with the Pyramid Code, and now with the New Atlantis, you're bringing on the next level of information, findings, and the full picture about this great legacy for humanity. So it's really the next level of deep education and inspiration, too.
It is.
Yeah. Carmen, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
What a pleasure. And in part two, we'll hear even more about this historic Turkish excavation tied to Atlantis and Egypt. And we hope, of course, for the safety and success of the team that's working on it in Turkey. I hope their work can proceed smoothly.
I hope so, too. I mean, I would go. But the thing is, the trouble's still happening in Turkey right now.
It's very volatile. And yet, they know to come to you with these important revelations and discoveries. So, you know, in a way, I think that's just providence. It's working out. It's coming toward you after all of your great work in the field. You know, it's really something else. The images are going to cause huge shock waves, so buckle up tight.
Oh, they're astonishing. And I only showed you a few of them.
Yes, we're going to look at a whole lot more in part two. Incredible work here. 2017 is the year of revelations, and the New Atlantis documentary series is a big part of that. You made history here today, right on the show. Carmen, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with Dr. Carmen Bolter on Akhenaten Discovery Changes History Forever. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries by going to www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Subscribe to our newsletter at darkjournalist.com to stay updated on the latest shows.